up. Good to be back with you again this evening. Thank you so much for coming and being here tonight. Many of you know that this past week, or maybe it was the week before last, that and it's in the news that a abortion draft was leaked by somebody from the United States Supreme Court. And as a result of that, there are many who are surmising that the court is about to overturn Roe versus Wade. And what that means, of course, is that it would return that decision back to the states. It doesn't outlaw abortion, but it just returns that decision back to the states. And each state, each legislature of the states will then make the decision about whether or not abortion would be legal or not in that state. And that's what many are talking about now. They're talking about the leak. They're talking about what this is going to mean. It doesn't mean that this is the actual decision that the court has made, but it looks like that may be what they will decide when the actual ruling comes down. And there's a lot of talk about that. You may have been talking to your neighbors, your friends, coworkers, I don't know. But I tell you, we as Christians need to be involved in the conversation. And we need to not just talk about, nothing wrong to talk about the legal ramifications of the leak and the what Roe versus Wade means, or overturning Roe versus Wade. We can talk about that, but this gives us an opportunity to talk about God's will concerning this matter. And we need to do that. We've talked about this before in other lessons, but we need to continue to be reminded of this. And I wanted to talk about some things that will help us as we discuss this issue with various ones. You know, really, how does God view abortion? And that's what we need to be talking about. Now, I know that it's not very pleasant at times. It's pleasant to talk, I say pleasant, it's not that uncomfortable to talk to those who agree with us. But the ones we need to be talking about where we have opportunity are those who don't agree with us. And we don't do this in some hateful way, in some harsh way, but we need to let them know why pro-lifers, why people who are pro-life are pro-life. Why is it that we oppose abortion? It's not that we are against women. It's not that we're against women's health. They need to know the reasons. And you might say, well, they already know. Well, some may, but there's some I don't think do know, because all they have heard is the other side, and they think that we're just hateful to women because we oppose abortion. Why is it that we oppose abortion? It is indeed a serious matter, and it's serious because it's serious. It is an issue we need to talk about, and we need to shout it from the housetops in the sense of never to be ashamed of the position that we hold, never hold back because it's going to be controversial. Let's be talking about it, especially where we have opportunities to talk to those who disagree, who do not believe that abortion is wrong. So let's talk about how does God view abortion. That's how we view it. And that's what we then need to present to others. Well, God hates the shedding of innocent blood. We find in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 16 and 17, that there are six things, yes, seven things that the Lord hates, he says. Yes, six things the Lord hates, yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood. God hates that. Psalm 106, the psalmist here is giving the history of the Israelites, of their history, how they had rebelled against God. Verses 36 to 38 says, they served their idols, which became a snare to them. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons and shed innocent blood. The blood of their sons and daughters whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. And so this was a reason they were carried off into captivity. The Lord was very much displeased with them. One of the reasons is they shed innocent blood. In Romans chapter 1, Paul is talking about how that the Gentiles have refused to acknowledge God. The things concerning God are clearly seen by looking at the things that are made, His everlasting power and Godhead, but they refuse to accept that information and to thrust the light of the truth from them, and they rejected the God, the true and living God. And they ended up then becoming morally depraved. He says at the beginning of verse 28, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful, who knowing the righteous judgment of God that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Now that's the condition of the Gentiles as a result of refusing to acknowledge God. And notice among these, he mentions murder, that is the killing of innocent people. He also mentions the unloving here in the New King James Version. The American Standard translates it without natural affection. The Greek word is astorge, or astorgos. And storge, or storgos, was one of the Greek terms for love. It meant love, and really it was a term that had to do with family love, especially of parents for children and children for parents. The love of kindred. And when you put the negative prefix to it, the A, that's a negative prefix, it means not that. So when he says unloving here, he's talking about not storgos. They don't have storgos. They don't have this love for family, for kindred. And so that's what maybe child abusers do. When they abuse their children, they get in anger and they mangle the bodies of their children. They're unloving. They are without natural affection. And it is sin, and we deplore that kind of activity or that kind of behavior. But that was what these Gentiles were involved in. And we would surmise maybe the unloving includes maybe child abusers. And then he says in verse 32, not just those who do these things, but those who practice those things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. These people are deserving of death in God's eyes, and not only that, those who approve of them. They may not actually do them, but they support it. And so we're talking about a serious matter when it comes to these practices of shedding innocent blood, murder, showing a lack of proper affection for our children, for our kindred. Well, the question comes, how do we know that abortion is the shedding of innocent blood? How do we know that that is not showing the proper affection toward family? How do we know that? Well, how does God view the unborn child? And that's what I want us to look at for a few minutes here. These are things you can show people. Here's the way God views abortion. And we know how he views the shedding of innocent blood, but is the killing of the unborn child the shedding of innocent blood? Is that what's happening? Is it actually killing an innocent person? Is that what is actually happening when you kill the unborn child? Well, let's talk about that unborn child. How does God view the unborn child? We know that God values the life of the unborn as much as He values the life of those already born. And one of the passages that I think proves this is Exodus 21, 22-25. Really, this is the only passage that I know of that deals specifically with the issue of harm done to an unborn child. And so this passage talks about harm that comes to an unborn child. Here in the American Standard Version, it says, and if men strive together, this is according to the law of Moses, and if men strive together and hurt a woman with child, so that her fruit depart, and yet no harm follow, He shall be surely fined according to the woman's husband, according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if any harm follow, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. Now, when this passage says here that her fruit depart, here this is in the American Standard Version, it means really that her child is born. The Hebrew word for the word fruit here in this passage is translated in other passages as child, boy, son. In fact, it is the second most common word in the Old Testament scriptures for the word child. The New King James Version and the New International Version translates this verse as she gives birth prematurely. And I think that's what's happening. The American Standard gives the exact rendering of the Hebrew. And that means her fruit, that is the child, departs. The child comes forth. That means the child is born, is what this is saying. And so here you have two men that are striving, fighting with one another, and a woman with child. She is pregnant. She has the child within her, and that child then is born. As a result, she prematurely, we would say, give birth to this child. Now, notice that the expression says nothing about the condition of the baby at birth, though, when it says her fruit depart. It doesn't tell us whether he is dead, alive but wounded, or alive and healthy. It doesn't tell us the condition of the child when he is born. Some people have assumed that the expression means a miscarriage. In the New American Standard Version, at one time, that's the way they translated this, that she has a miscarriage, which means the child is dead. That does not depict or express the Hebrew, because the Hebrew is expressed here, her child departs, her child is born. So it doesn't tell us the condition of the child, whether the child is alive or dead, whether it is healthy or not. So the baby is born, what then? Well, it depends on whether or not harm is done. He says, and yet no harm follow. But harm to whom? When he says no harm follow. Well, since we understand that the child is born, that the concern here would not only be harm to the mother, but the concern would also be, is there harm to the child? The child is born. So if no harm follow to whom? To either the mother or the child, then he shall be surely fined according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. But if harm does follow, harm to whom? Either the mother or the child. Then he shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Whatever the harm was to the mother or the child, that was what was to be done to the man who caused it. That means that if the child died in this act, and this two men striving, the one who caused this, and this child comes forth and it's dead, then that man's life was to be taken. Now what that tells me that God places as much value on the life of that unborn child, that which was growing inside the mother, as he does upon the life of the one who has already been born. And so, since that's the way God values the life of that unborn child, then that is how that we need to value that unborn child. What this proves is that God values the life of the unborn child. And so we need to value that. But you know, not only do we see that here in this passage, back in 1973, when Roe versus Wade was decided by the court, there was some question. I remember when this happened. And I remember that the debate, even among Christians, is can we prove that the conception, that this which is conceived inside the mother, if that is really a life separate apart from the mother. There were some questions about that. Really, when does life begin? When does a person become an entity distinct from his mother? When is it a life distinct from the mother? Now, as we studied Scripture, we come to realize God values that life. But the science is not where it is today then. But in the past 50 years, what we have learned about the unborn child leads us to the conclusion there is no question about the unborn child being a life separate and apart from the mother. What is going inside the mother's womb? Science has proven that a unique human life begins at conception. You know, we've heard a lot in the past couple of years, follow the science, follow the science. Well, let's follow the science here as we consider what we know to be true through scientific investigation and research and all of that. We have determined that that which is conceived has its own unique genetic code with 46 chromosomes. We also know that at conception, the inherited characteristics of a unique human being is established and will remain in force for the entire life of this individual. I mean, what that which has been conceived has is its own chromosomes separate and apart from the mother. Also, this unborn entity is unlike any that has been conceived before and unlike any that will ever be conceived again. Each cell in the baby's body is unique and different from the cells of any other human being, even that of the mother. At the time the baby is about 1 month old, all major organs have begun developing. Brains and nerves, eyes, lungs, stomach and intestines, kidneys, etc., they have begun to be formed. The heart begins to beat and circulate blood on the 18th day. The baby has his own blood system separate from the mother. By the time the baby is three months old, all body systems are present and operating. From this point on, no new body parts will be added. The baby simply increases in size and weight and skill in using its body through the last 6 months in the mother's womb. All he needs is nourishment to grow and a proper environment in which to grow, and his mother provides that for him. And so what do we learn about what is growing inside the mother? It is an entity that is separate and apart from the mother. It has its own blood system, its own chromosomes, its own parts that it needs in order to live. All it needs inside the mother is a proper environment in which to grow and nourishment. You know, even after that baby is born, if you just leave that baby laying there, it's going to die. It's going to need some help if it's going to live. And so the mother's still going to have to, or someone's going to have to, provide it with food, with nourishment, proper environment in which to live. It's still going to have to be provided, but the same thing that happened within the womb is still going to happen outside the womb. Nourishment, proper environment, in order for that child then to grow. And that's all that has been taking place inside that mother's womb before that baby is born. So what do we conclude? Well, we conclude that it is a life separate and apart from the mother. What kind of life? Well, it's the offspring of a human being, so it would be human life. It is a living human being. Someone has said abortion stops a beating heart. And that's right. It's the killing of human life. And so even when you look at it from a scientific standpoint, we can conclude without any shadow of a doubt that this is a human living being separate and apart from the mother. And to kill it is to kill another human being other than the mother. You know, the Bible even indicates this as well. Look in Psalm 139. The psalmist said, and David is the psalmist here, he says, "For you formed my inward parts, you covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are your works, and that my soul knows very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written. The days fashioned for me when as yet there were none of them." Now, who is it that's inside the mother's womb here? Notice David says, "You formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you. Your eyes saw my substance." Who's the me and the my here? That's David. David was the one that was being formed. You know, if David's mother had had an abortion, you know who she would have killed? David. And David would have never been here upon this earth, king of Israel. He would have been dead. Why? Because his mother killed him within the womb. Look with me also in Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 4 and 5. Jeremiah says, "Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctified you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations." Who was formed within his mother's womb here? Well, it was Jeremiah. And again, if Jeremiah's mother had had an abortion, she would have killed Jeremiah. This is an entity that is separate and apart from the mother. And also, the Bible identifies the unborn child by terms that mean a human individual. Look with me in Genesis chapter 25, verses 21 and 22. This is concerning Isaac and Rebekah. Rebekah, you know, had been barren, but now she's with child, with twins. It says, "Now Isaac pleaded with the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, If all is well, why am I like this? So she went to inquire of the Lord." But notice, she said, the text says, but the children struggled together within her. Notice what is the two that are within her are called children. Children. Look with me also in Ruth 1 verse 11. Here's what Naomi says to her two daughters-in-law after her husband had died and her two sons had died and her daughters-in-law, Moabites. She says for them to stay in Moab. She's going back to Israel. And she said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands?" If she was with child and she had sons within her womb, what were they? They're called sons. It's not fetal tissue. It was not just a blob of protoplasm, not a part of her body. It was sons, children that are in the womb. That's how the Bible refers to them. Look with me in the New Testament, in Luke chapter 1, verse 36. It says, "Now indeed Elizabeth, your relative," this is the angel speaking to Mary, and Elizabeth was her relative, "she has also conceived a son in her old age, and this is now the sixth month for her who was called barren." Now you remember Zacharias and Elizabeth. Elizabeth had been barren, and now she is with child. But it says that she had conceived a son in her old age. What had she conceived? Well, she conceived a son. Now the word son in this passage is from the Greek word weos. And weos is a word of different meaning depending upon the context. But in those passages where it refers to the physical offspring of humans, such as the one we're talking about here, then the word refers to that which is a human individual separate and distinct from his parents. This word is the most common word in the New Testament scriptures for a son. And here it's referring to Elizabeth's son inside the womb. That's what is growing inside the womb, is her son. And there are many other places in the New Testament where this word weos is found, where it refers to a son. One of them is in Luke chapter 1, verse 57, where it says, "Now Elizabeth's full time came for her to be delivered, and she brought forth a son." Now note the parallel here. In verse 36, it says that Elizabeth conceived a son. In verse 57, it says Elizabeth brought forth a son. These two verses refer to the same mother and the same son in the same context. One verse refers to the conception, the other refers to her birth, but both call the child a son. And this son was John the Baptist. Now, if John was human at the time of his birth and onward, why not conclude that he was a human being from the time of his conception onward? He was not subhuman when he was born and then later became human. We all know that he was a full human being at the time that he was born. But let me tell you again, remember, he can't live on his own. If he doesn't have some help, he's going to die after he's born. So even though he's vulnerable, even though he needs some nourishment and somebody's going to have to give him nourishment, he's not subhuman. Even though he's in that condition, he just needs someone to help him to be receive nourishment, to have the proper environment in which to live, to be clothed. But he's a human being, even though he's a baby, a child. Why would we then conclude that he's subhuman from conception only? It's a life separate and apart from the mother. The Bible calls him a son, just the same way he calls him after he's been born. All the conclusions, or rather, all that we see draws us, leads us to draw the conclusion that that which is growing inside the mother is a child, a son, a baby, a living human being. So God values the life of the unborn as much as he values the life of those already born. God views the unborn as a child, a human individual, distinct and separate from his mother and father. Therefore, to intentionally kill the unborn child is to shed innocent blood. That's the only conclusion that we can come to. And we need to think of what has happened over the past 50 years and the millions, over 60 million babies have been slaughtered. And when you read about what they do in abortion, it's just appalling of how they treat those babies in the womb. Cutting them up, sucking them out. It ought to just bring tears to our eyes to even think about that. But it's happened for so long, it's been a right for so long, that we then have become desensitized to it, I think is what happens, or what can happen. And one reason I'm preaching this now is for us to be reminded of what is actually happening. Now we have an opportunity to talk with people about this, and we need to talk to them about what really is inside that mother's womb. And the God who created us, his view toward that unborn child, and the killing of that unborn child, how does he view that? It is the shedding of innocent blood. And remember, Judah went into captivity because Manasseh shed very much innocent blood. It says 2 Kings 21 verse 6, "Also he made his sons pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, and continued and consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger." In verse 16, "Moreover, Manasseh shed very much innocent blood, till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to the other, to another, besides his sin by which he made Judah sin in doing evil in the sight of the Lord." And in fact, scriptures say that Manasseh did worse than the nations that were around about them. And one of them is the shedding of innocent blood. Also in 2 Kings 24 verses 3 and 4, "Surely at the commandment of the Lord, this came upon Judah to remove them from his sight because of the sins of Manasseh, according to all that he had done, and also because of the innocent blood that he had shed, for he had filled Jerusalem with innocent blood, which the Lord would not pardon." There's no question in my mind that this nation is going to be judged for the shedding of innocent blood that they have over the past 50 years. God will decide. It's not whittling on God's end of the stick, but unless there is a turning around, unless there is a genuine repentance and a turning around of this, then there will come judgment. And this will be one of the reasons why a nation is destroyed. That's what happened to Judah. Well, let me just very briefly mention, what can we do? Well, we are to preach against it. We need to try to change the hearts of people. I'm talking to the choir here, as we might say, and I'm stating it very strongly. But let us be careful in how we present the truth to those who would differ with us on this, present it in love, but present it very clearly what the Bible teaches. Ephesians 5 and verse 11 says, "And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them." It's not enough just not to have fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness. He says expose them. In other words, bring it to light. Show it to the world that this is an unfruitful work of darkness. We have that responsibility. 2 Timothy 4 and verse 2, "Preach the word, be ready in season, out of season, convince, rebuke, exhort with all longsuffering and teaching." Convince people of the error of their way. And also, we should work toward changing policy where we have ability and opportunity. There's nothing wrong with, as we are citizens of a nation, to do all we can to try to bring about a change in that nation. You remember Josiah, the king? He made improvements or got rid of the idolatry that was in the land because they had turned against God. He had heard the book of the law read to him, and he realized because of what Judah was doing that they are under God's wrath. They are not pleasing to the God of heaven. And so he went about making some changes. And that's what we can do. Do all we can to make changes. He was the king. We are not the king. We're not the president. But we surely can make a difference in who becomes president, who becomes governor, who becomes the legislatures. For in the eighth year of his reign, while he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David. And in the 12th year, he began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images. They broke down the altars of the Baals in his presence, and in the incense altars which were above them he cut down, and the wooden images, the carved images, and the molded images he broke in pieces, and made dust of them and scattered it on the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. Look at 2 Chronicles 34:33. "Thus Josiah removed all the abominations from all the country that belonged to the children of Israel, and made all who were present in Israel diligently serve the Lord their God. All his days they did not depart from following the Lord God of their fathers." He made a difference. Esther, you remember, who was the queen, the wife of Ahasuerus, the king of the Persians. And a decree had been made that on a certain day the Jews would be massacred, all of them would be killed. Esther was a Jew. She did not make that known to her husband. When the decree had been made, then Mordecai, Esther's uncle, then sent word to her and said, "You need to go into the king and plead for your people." And she sent back and said, "Well, there is a law, the Medes and Persians, that if you go to the king unsummoned, if he doesn't put out the golden scepter, then you'll be put to death." So there was a risk involved in her. I think it says that he had not called her for 30 days. And so there was a risk. Well, here's what Mordecai said, sent back to Esther. "Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." In other words, speak up, Esther. where you have opportunity to make a difference, speak up. And that's what she did. And that's what the Lord is calling upon us to do, to speak up in the society in which we live. We surely must not support the evil of abortion. We should speak out against it. We need to try to change the hearts of people. And we need to be careful that we don't do anything that will then support that. You remember what Paul said in Romans 1 and verse 32, after he mentions the sins of the Gentiles, he says, who knowing the righteous judgment of God, that those who practice such things are deserving of death, not only do the same, but also approve of those who practice them. Be careful in giving support to those legislators, those who are running for the legislature, who would then vote to continue the killing of the unborn child. I would have a difficult time to vote for anybody to get them into a position where they could then make a decision about this issue, who would believe it's okay to kill the unborn child. I don't want to be a part of that at all in supporting that evil that has taken over our country. But there's an opportunity now where that might can be turned around. But I tell you, the way we turn things around for the most part is not through laws and voting and all of that. It's through changing the hearts of people. And it looks like we are losing the battle in this country. But let's don't give up. The gospel of Christ is the power of God unto salvation. Let's be out there doing all we can to get people to turn back to God, to turn to God. And when they do that, they're going to see, yes, this is an evil. This is against the God who created us, and this is something that needs to be stopped. And so that's the primary work that we need to do, is to carry the gospel to the world. Well, these are some things I hope are helpful as we are facing this issue at the present, and opportunities may come up for you to talk with people about this. If there are any here this evening who need to respond to the invitation of our Lord in any way, please come while together we stand and sing.